This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Brew Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the Riptide. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer, this is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters. We're back with another live episode of Brew Strong here with my good friend, Fal Allen, beer genius. And you've been around much longer than your years would suggest. You've got your barley wine book, you got your Goza book. You've been successful in this country, other countries around the world brewing beer. You just have an amazing history.
I'm very lucky.
Yeah, I think you make your own luck.
Yeah. To some degree, but I have been right place, right time a few times.
Whatever you can do to make yourself lucky, you got to do. And it is sometimes just seeing the opportunity and being willing to do the hard work to make things happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, look at John Blickman, our good friend. He is Blickman Engineering. This makes all that cool brewing gear that innovates your brew day. They have that available. Most brew shops carry it or can get it for you. So check out your local homebrew shop. Ask them what Blickman gear they have. They got everything from the basic Anvil series up to the high-end Blickman gear and then pro stuff as well. If you want to get into pro brewing and you're already brewing on Blickman gear, check them out for the pro stuff. One thing I know is that John Blickman really takes quality seriously and believes in the customer and makes sure the customer is taken care of. And he's a great guy. He's paid for the show for 15 years. So if you get a chance, check out Blickman Engineering. You're out there on the web. Well, let's see here. Questions. You did the barley wine book. How many years ago?
I think that came out in 98. So what is that? 24 years?
Like 100?
Yeah, it feels like
124. Wow, that is a long time ago. You're just a child back then.
Still a young man.
A young whippersnapper. Were you old enough to drink when you wrote that book?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I co-authored it with Dick Cantwell, who's a great brewer and a very knowledgeable guy and a much better writer than I am. Thank you for that. We had early on, we used to brew together at a place called Pike Place Brewing in Seattle. And we had both started writing beer articles. And he said, so if someone asked you which of the Style Guidelines series books, what would you want to do? And we both said at the same time, barley wine, because you make good barley wine, you make a good other beer, because it's a really hard style. It's high alcohol, a lot of technical issues. So one day, the woman who was running the Brewers publication said to me, would you like to write one of our style guideline books? And if so, which? Obviously, barley wine. And then I had a built-in partner, Dick, because he'd already said the same thing.
Yeah, I like that book, and I love good barley wine. And there's such a range to them, too. Giles asks, I'm hoping to brew my first barley wine soon, but I have an issue with my mash tun size. I don't have access to a larger mash tun, and the highest gravity I can reach with a full-size mash is about 1080, which is about right. It tends to max out around 1080, 1085 anyways. The target original gravity for my barley wine will be 1.100. So my question is, since I don't want to use extract, Should I do 2 no sparge mashes to get my volume and gravity? And what would the potential drawbacks of that option be? Or would I be better served doing 1 mash with my specialty grains and a separate mini mash with the rest of my base grains to hit my gravity? I considered using my first runnings for my sparge if I did the double mash, but I'm afraid of leaving too much behind in the mash if I did that. If it matters, I do batch sparging. Thanks. You have any thoughts on that?
I think his initial idea of 2 separate, 2 mashes, 2 times is probably your best option. I really like the idea of doing a separate mash with your specialty grain. You get a little more cohesive flavor, probably also get a little better extract. Your specialty malt doesn't have a lot of enzymes. Your main mash will. Mashing twice is a little bit of a pain, but you're going to get the gravity you want. Basically the same thing. The drawback would be if something went really wrong with one of your mashes. That's always a potential problem. So okay. That would be the best bet. His point about losing some gravity by not sparging, that's always going to be the case with these big beers. But you can do what they do in England. Just do, you know, make a second beer, a small beer.
Yeah.
Which I think that those are great beers. So it's a win-win, but does make for a long brew day.
Yeah, that's an excellent point on making the small beer afterwards. Yeah, there's really no waste. Yeah, he doesn't want to use extract. I think the extracts have also gotten quite good these days. I don't see a problem with boosting your gravity with really high quality, fresh DME or liquid malt extract and getting the rest of your gravity that way. Especially, there's really nice, you know, extracts made from Maris Otter that have a great character to them, perfect for a barley wine. A lot of options there. And then there's some really light extracts that don't add a lot of flavor that are just, you can add in there. And you should be adding some simple sugars as well. Most barley wines, don't they have a simple sugar component to them? Especially
I think ones. To British style, and it was pretty common for breweries to add somewhere between 10 and 15% sucrose of some sort in there. So I wouldn't shy away from that either. If you can get your gravity to say 1070 or 75 and you really want to be at 80 or 85, add some sugar. I don't think in a beer like that it will show much. You really won't be able to taste the sugar. What you may get is that higher alcohol effect a little bit. But when we do barley wines, we usually add somewhere between 5 and 10% of sugar. And we did that with our triple and our double as well.
And one of the things he mentions is, I think, a double mash, which we started calling it polyguile.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of partyguile, polyguile, you take the runnings from the first mash and add it to another set of grain. And what I found is it's additive. It's strictly additive. There's hardly any loss whatsoever. And so you could take that grain, and if you're getting 1080 out of it, and you do the same thing again using your runnings, you'll get 160. It'll just adds together. Yeah, I had mentioned this to Blickman at some conference. Somebody was talking about size of a kettle or something. And so Blickman went ahead and did some tests on that, doing that exact thing. And he's like, yeah, they just, the numbers add. It's strictly additive. I wouldn't think that would work, but it does.
Sure.
And I actually ended up doing a beer with Yepa from Evil Twin, where we did a double version of our Evil Twin beer. And we did a quadruple version, 15% version of it. And we did the that MASH technique where we took the wort out, cleared our larder tun, and then doughed in another set of grains using the first runnings, and had no trouble getting up to the gravity we needed, like, what was it, 30 Plato, 31, 32, something like that.
Amazing.
Yeah. I didn't think it would work, but after Blickman did that testing, I was just like, this will work. And sure enough, it did. I don't try that now. Just logically, you wouldn't think it would.
Pretty substantial loss. I would think that you get like 50% gain, but really getting close to 100% gain, that's...
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty cool.
It's not off at all. And I don't understand how it works, because you would think you need a certain osmotic gravity of water for penetrating the starches and all this and hydrating everything, but it works. And the water still goes out and goes into the grain. And
yeah, I guess the saturation level of sugar into liquid is so much lower than that you're like, sure, fine, we can do that. Saturated or anywhere near, I guess.
There's got to be a limit to it, but
yeah.
Most people, when they do a maximum amount of grain, the most they can get on their runnings is about 1080, 1085, and that's where it just tops out. Why it works additively, I don't know. Let's see. I still need to come out and do a collab with you.
Absolutely. We're down.
Maybe we could do the polyguile.
Yeah.
On some things.
Yeah, hey, do a barley one.
Alcohol always sells well. A barley one, yes. All right. Let's see here. Got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have more of your questions right after this.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Are you looking for a simple brewing system that's great for all grain brewing, but everything on the market seems to be full of compromises? Blickman Engineering has the answer. The Blickman Brew Easy All Grain Brewing System. The Brew Easy is a complete system with easy upgrades and a beautiful compact design, perfect for any size brewing location. At its core, the Brew Easy is built on two gorgeous Blickman Boilermaker brew kettles, a high temperature March pump, and either a top tier gas burner or the new Boil Coil electric heater. The Brew Easy adapter lid allows the pots to stack on top of each other, forming an efficient, strong, and compact brewing setup that comes in 5, 10, and 20-gallon batch sizes. Upgrade your BrewEasy system with full automated control by adding a Blickman Tower of Power temp controller, and make moving around easy with the Blickman Kettle Cart. The BrewEasy is modular. If you already own a Boilermaker kettle, you can build your BrewEasy by purchasing just the modules you need. The new BrewEasy all-grain brewing system. See it today at BlickmanEngineering.com and brew with Blickman quality on your new BrewEasy. Easy.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer into beer. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. We're talking Q&A. Your questions answered here. A lot of these people have sent in over the years. You can send them in to brewstrong@thebrewingnetwork.com. And I have vowed to answer every question that has been sent in. If it kills me, one way or another, I've gotten them done. We keep doing that. And people keep sending questions in. Here's one from just a couple of weeks ago. Terry asks, greetings. First, thanks for all you do for the brewing community. Can't say thank you enough. In an upcoming Q&A, could you review recommendations for storing Belgian beers? I've got a Belgian blonde ale that has done pretty good in competitions, and I've noticed it starting to decline in scoring. I've been storing it around 36 degrees, and I assume Fahrenheit, And this has got me thinking, maybe I should be leaving this type of style in the basement to age. Curious how you'd recommend storing aging Belgian blondes, doubles, triples, and these types of ales. Thank you in advance, Terry. How do you store your Belgian beers? Do you store Belgian beers?
I store them a little warmer than 36. I've read that kind of your optimal range is somewhere between the high 30s and the high 40s. So I'm somewhere around 45, 50.
Kind of cellar temperature?
Yeah. And by and large, I don't store beer anymore. Mm-hmm. Drink it as fast as I can, which isn't always that fast. But even with Belgian beers, with a few exceptions, they don't get a lot better with age. Now, some people might disagree with this, but it's a matter of taste, because I think hoppy beers certainly fall apart quickly. Mm-hmm. The hop degrades and they don't store very well at all. Darker, less hoppy beers store better.
Mm-hmm.
And there's science behind that. The hops aren't in there to fall apart and oxidize and do all kinds of weird things. The dark color, the melanoidin, is a receptor for oxygen. So those beers oxidize less and slower. And I think the darker flavor covers some of that oxidation and works better with it. And you get this kind of sherry, pruny, port flavors that I think work well with dark malt. And they don't work well in, say, West Coast IPA. So for any lighter, hoppier beers, I just drink them as quick as I can. If someone gives me a beer and it goes more than about a month, I'm suspect as to whether it's going to be any good. Mm-hmm. And then darker beers, I usually try and get to them quick too, because they don't always do well. I've opened a few lately that I've been very disappointed, wish I'd consumed them sooner. There is an exception. There are a couple. I bought a case of Rochefort. And the first beer out was not that great. I thought, that's not what I remember. So I put it in the closet, and it went about a year before I pulled the next one out, and it was better. And I was like, huh, that's weird. You wouldn't think that it'd be noticeably better. Maybe it's just my memory. And so I let it sit for another 6 months or so, and they just kept getting better and better. After about 4 years, that 24-pack was gone. And the last one was the best one.
Yeah, and I think there's always something going on. Even if something is pure and clean, there is the act of time and temperature and gravity, you know, the dropout of ultrafine particles improves the head retention, improves clarity of the beer, and it can affect flavor as well. But a lot of times, for most homebrewed beers, I would say that there's a fairly high chance that there is some sort of other organism in there, and that may be changing beers over time. Sometimes the beers aren't 100% attenuated as much as the yeast can do, and the yeast will keep working. As you store it, even at 36 degrees, the yeast can keep working, and that's going to change the beer. Perhaps it gets a little thinner, maybe less sweet, or maybe the sweetness was balanced before, and now it's dried out a little bit and losing that sweetness. Maybe the beer's come out of balance, and that's why it's not as good. So I'm with you. I generally, if a beer tastes great, that's the time to drink it.
Yeah. And
we go for it in droves.
Yeah. And I think you're absolutely right that everything has its arc. That's a bell curve. And even we have our peak point. I'm not there yet, of course, myself. But
mine was a long time ago. I don't know if you know that.
But if you have yeast still in the beer, that protects it for a certain length of time. Eventually, that yeast autolyzes. Yes. It either self-autolyzes or it just gets so old it breaks apart and decays. And that releases the inner cell cytoplasm into the beer. And that has a flavor of its own. So if you're storing your beers, whether they're Belgian or whatever, and they're on yeast, that changes your bell curve. And it's something to be very aware of, because those flavors are rarely additive. They're almost always meaty and unpleasant. So there's another thing to keep in mind. What conditions that beer is in? Did it have yeast? Did it have a lot of hops? And for Terry here, who writes in, I think his blonde ale, being blonde, is going to have a much shorter bell curve than, say, a double, you know, that would, because of the dark color, would be able to age longer better.
So what would you say would improve storing those lighter Belgian ales? Would it be filtering out the yeast, or first, or if you don't have filtration, letting it sit in the keg for a couple of months cold, let everything as much drop out, and then package it? Or
I think, you know,
what else?
Lagering that beer really cold would help. I think part of making a shelf stable beer goes back to the brew house, so you got to do the right things in the brew house to get you know, all of that taken care of. You don't have a good solid boil, you're not going to precipitate some of the things that need to come out of there. You're not going to drive off some of the sulfur compounds. So the longevity of a beer starts in the brew house, probably actually starts out in the field somewhere, but we don't have any control over that. You got to make a good beer, a good solid beer in the brew house. And then as it moves through fermentation, make sure you do a good job there. And after fermentation, you need to exclude oxygen as, you know, as much as you possibly can, which is harder for home brewers. And it would help to get all that yeast out of there one way or the other, through filtration or aging. But then you don't have anything to scavenge that oxygen, so you really got to be careful packaging it.
Oh, and you bring up just the process from one of the things that I was told is the amount of heat load that the beer has had in being created shortens its shelf life. And it has to do even with crystal caramel malts. More heat was applied when they were malted. It seems to kind of reverse itself on some of the black malts. But that, the amount of heat put in the mash, the amount of heat put in the lautering, the amount of heat in the boil, excessive boiling can actually shorten your shelf life. So I see a lot of homebrewers and a fair number of commercial brewers just boiling the daylights out of the wort. It's like a little is good, a lot's better. And that could possibly be shortening the stability of your beer as well. Only boil as much as you need. You're not wasting energy, and it's going to turn out better. Let's see. Daniel writes, Jamel, looking for your input on lowering the final gravity of a barley wine after primary fermentation finished. Background, I created a barley wine with an OG of 1086 and used Lagunitas yeast obtained from an awesome rally in Chicago. The yeast was used to create a 2-liter starter, and primary fermentation ran for 2 weeks with a final gravity of 1024. This produced an attenuation of 71%, which is the highest that the Lagunitas yeast, Y yeast 68, is rated at. I was thinking now pitching a starter of White Lab super high gravity yeast to try and get it lower, maybe add 1-2% ABV. This worked for me in the past with a huge Russian Imperial Stout, but it wasn't drinkable for 6 months, and it had a bigger and broader grain bill. Thoughts, questions, concern, advice. Thanks, Evan. All right, thanks, Daniel. I'm real leery of trying to get something started after it's attenuated 71%. You might eke out another small point or two, but I doubt you're going to get it down enough for another 2% ABV.
If you added the right yeast in the right, absolutely right conditions, if you went to a champagne yeast or I've heard tell that this Kuvaik yeast, which we'll know about in a few more days, I'll know more about it, but I've heard that it can really take a beer down a long way. But having said that, I think your point's a good one. You're not going to get a lot more because there's no oxygen. Yeast needs oxygen to ferment. So yeah. If you just put it into a finished beer, you got two things going against you. There's no oxygen, so that's going to be hard for that yeast to get going. It can only go on the glycogen and reserves that it already has. And you're putting it into a toxic environment that contains both ethanol and some carbonation, some CO2 is entrained in that liquid. And both of those are things yeast don't like. So right. It's going to be hard for that yeast to really get going.
I would consider maybe throwing in a little Brett.
They will finish up almost anything under right. almost any conditions, but it does take a long time and right. you're going to end up with some Brett flavors.
Right. But could be interesting in a barley wine to have some Brett.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it'd be delicious.
Yeah. I would, that would probably be what I would try. I would give that a go. Let's see here. So Kuvaik yeast, final pH water chemistry question. Steve asks, hi, very long time listener, first time question. First off, I started brewing about the same time Jamel started his show. I've truly listened to every episode, some multiple times. My brewing Bibles have been Jamel and John's books. They are stained and tatty and referenced and notated. So thanks so much sincerely for basically training me over the last almost two decades. Oh my God, I'm old. I recently tried Kuvaik yeast. Of the three beers I've used this yeast on, all have ended up perceivably more acidic than the same recipes using my regular yeast, Cal Ale yeast. I use RO water and treat it minimally with calcium carbonate and calcium sulfate, and if necessary, lactic acid. I shoot for 100 parts per million calcium, and the sulfate carbonate ratio varies depending on the beer. pH is calculated with a spreadsheet, and lactic acid, or rarely baking soda, is used to target a mash pH of 5.5 at room temperature. The Kuvaik beers I discovered and then confirmed in a paper online drop the pH lower than other yeast strains. Here's the actual question. If I adjust the pH up in the mash to the upper end of the recommended mash pH with salts, will that translate to a higher pH in the beer after fermentation? In other words, how can I end up with a less acidic beer using this yeast strain? Kettle additions, perhaps? Thanks so much for the years and years of brewing discussion. Steve from Melbourne Beach, Florida.
See what you've done to this poor man? You've got him. You started him brewing.
Yeah. 20 years of listening to me. Yeah. I don't know what to say.
There are apparently three or four strains or variations on the Kuvaik yeast. Be interesting to know which one he used, and because I think they all are they have mm-hmm. different flavor profiles and probably different acid production profiles. And some of them have more bacteria in them than others. So it'd be interesting to know what strain he used and where it came from. But all yeast produce different amounts of different byproducts. So it's interesting. I don't know if adjusting the pH would cause that yeast to behave differently, or if it would just produce as much acid as it felt it needed.
I think it might slightly change the behavior, but I think it's, if you start with a higher pH, you'll end with a higher pH. I think that will be the case. Another option is you can adjust your pH after fermentation. Yeah. So if you're going to add essentially caustic, a lot of commercial brewers will add a little caustic to bump their pH. So post-ferment adjustments are allowed. So you can give that a try. If you bump up your starting pH, your finishing pH will be a bit higher.
Would you do that adjustment with sodium hydroxide?
I have tasted beers that have been adjusted with sodium hydroxide. It actually works just fine. Yeah. You have to be careful it doesn't have all the other stuff in it, all the Surfactants.
Agents and surfactants, yeah. And the other thing that comes to mind is I read an article somewhere that talked about how some of this acid production in some yeast is tied to gravity. So the more alcohol it makes, the more acid it makes.
Sure.
So if you have a lower gravity beer, it's just going to produce less acid than it would in a higher gravity beer. So that might be one way to control it as well.
That's an interesting thought. Yeah, that makes perfect sense because they're producing the acids out of the act of fermenting. So the more they ferment, the more acid they'll produce. Yeah, that brings up some interesting questions for them. Let's see here. All right. Let's take another short break. And when we come back, we'll have more of your questions right after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
I wanted to tell you about my friends at Brew Chatter. They're up in Reno, Sparks, Nevada, to be exact. But real close to Reno. They have a great homebrew shop up there. You can check them out online, brewchatter.com. They got all the goodies if you want to make anything from barley wine to like Kvike yeast, they've got it all. I've known them for some years now, and just love those guys. Josh, RJ, wonderful folks, very knowledgeable. They'll treat you like you're the only customer in the world. Good folks. Check them out, brewchatter.com. All right. Well, let's see here. We've got a question from Jason about increasing yeast viability. He said, hey, during yeast counting with our bottom cropping from the cone of our fermenters, we continuously get about 65% viability, which I know is too little. How do we increase this? We have so far just been pitching dry yeast from up top. I know you have said to rehydrate the dry yeast in previous podcasts, but one of our employees had attended a yeast seminar a few years back and said that that should not be a problem, not hydrating it. But I still wonder if it affects the flocculated yeast at the bottom. What do you think? What's your take on that, Phil?
First, I'd be curious to know how they're checking their viability. 65% is incredibly low for, you know, a yeast to repitch. Right. We don't, here at the brewery, pitch anything below 90 unless we're in some sort of emergency situation. Mm-hmm. We really look for yeast 89% or above, and really we'd like it 95 or above. So the method that they're using to check that viability may be in question, and they may be getting a false reading. So I would check that. I would, you know, take a look at how you're checking that viability and look at other options to check it, and maybe go through your methodology, make sure you're not overstaining if you're using a stain or however you're doing it. Then your next question is, that's pretty darn low. Why is it so low? And then there are a lot of variables here. How old is it when you're checking it? Is it post-fermentation a month or post-fermentation a week? So that's going to have a lot to do with it. And viability, while stored, can be very strain specific. When I was brewing in Singapore, I had a strain that produced these awesome flavors. I loved the yeast strain for the flavors. But if I let it go more than 2 or 3 days at the bottom of the fermenter, my viability started to crash dramatically. And unless you're just brewing constantly, I could never mm-hmm. but you couldn't keep that yeast going. So I had to change strains to one that had more longevity. And the next strain I used, that I didn't have that problem at all. It lasted up to about 3 weeks. So it can be very strain dependent. And then are you keeping, is the cone of your fermenter chilled, or is it room temperature?
In that cone, when the yeast packs down in there, you can get some real heating going on. You need to be careful. I mean, you can't really keep it in there a long time. Also, I wonder if they're pitching dry yeast, there may be some loss of the dry yeast. And if you're just taking the very first yeast that come out of that cake at the bottom, you may be getting the stuff that dropped real early and died off early, and maybe further into the creamy center of the yeast mass, you'd get something with a higher viability. Yeah, it is odd that 65, and it says consistently. Yeah, I would wonder, like you're saying, the temperature, the timing. I would reconfirm your lab methods by perhaps getting some sort of known sample that has high viability and then testing it and see, or maybe there's another brewery that's getting high viability and they'd be willing to test your yeast and see what they come up with. That could be, I don't know where he's located, but there's labs around in California that would do that for you. Not very expensive. And it would, once you work out that your viability testing is correct, that's a huge tool that you can use in the future. So it's worth getting that dialed in, I would think. Yeah. I'm not sure why. Could be other things. It could be the types of beers they're brewing. Perhaps they're brewing something really super high gravity and they're getting some loss. Maybe they're repitching and they're not using any nutrients. Maybe their water and other adjustments are not conducive to that. Yeah, there's a lot of questions. I would have a lot of questions. I'd have to see it myself to kind of figure out why.
Yeah. It's a pretty broad and topic and tough question to answer without knowing a lot more detail.
Yeah. Jason, if that's still going on, try some of those things and then reach back out if that's still not working for you. Then maybe we can figure something out to resolve that. Let's see. Adam in the chat. He says, speaking to historical beers and brewing from the earlier show and Fowl's beautiful kettles. You got some beautiful kettles on you, dude. It's been a while since I've heard people talk much about copper and beer. I know some have a piece of copper fixed in their boil kettle or have a copper pipe they suspend during the boil. Distillers talk about the importance even more in the dome or column during distillation. How important is copper to you guys these days?
We don't have a lot of copper in our system. The interior of those tanks are stainless. We recently replaced some of the copper parts that were in the mash tun. And we haven't seen any changes with the yeast health. Copper is a micronutrient that yeast needs. So I think we probably get enough of it just from the liquid that evaporates out of the boil, condenses on the dome, which is still copper, and then runs back down into the tank. You don't need a lot for brewing. He makes a point about distilling, and you absolutely need it in distilling. And I'm not sure this is entirely true, but my experience, as well as what I've heard from other distillers, is, not that I'm a distiller, I don't have a license for that. That would be illegal. But if you don't have copper in your process, you can't make a good distillate. It's not possible.
Yeah. We had a still, and I did distilling class of Siebel and all that. And the copper in distilling can take out a lot of sulfur, a lot of other compounds. You'll see it build up on the copper. And it can be an important part in brewing too. Like Val was saying, it's a nutrient that the yeast can use. I'm not sure if zinc also can fill that role. And I know magnesium, certain elements will take the role of copper. And so I think most modern brewers are using zinc in some form or another. And I think that the copper is that important anymore. I think as a home brewer, it's cool if you can work in a copper element to your process. You can transfer wort through copper, or a lot of home brewers use a copper wort chiller that they put in a copper coil. And I got to imagine that's definitely helps out in that realm. All righty. Let's see here. Meads and Asserglen. Matt writes, Jamel and John, love the show. Just got into it, but have been binge listening and really enjoy it. I brew a couple hundred gallons per year and wish I could brew more. So early December, I had two fermenters bubbling, and I decided I shouldn't brew more beer as the kegerator had two on tap. That brought me to thinking that we have honeybees in the summer, and even in every spring we do maple syrup. Interestingly enough, both are fermentable. Game on. So I added enough honey to the water to make an OG of 1.130, and then added yeast nutrient and exciter from LD Carlson and stirred the living shit out of it. Tried to push enough O2 into it. I did this for the next 4 days, and the yeast helpers stirred to get rid of CO2 and into O2. Intro O2. Let's see here. Then I let it sit 4 weeks at 68 degrees Fahrenheit. The gravity was 1020 at that time, but the nose and taste are really harsh alcohol. I racked it off and have tried it after 2 months with no change. The Asserglen maple syrup wine is the same thing. What do you think is the harsh alcohol smell? Should I bottle it or just leave it in the secondary fermenter? Or is there something I can do to clean it up? I have went out and got some Fermade K for the next batches, but I wonder if you can suggest something to me to save this batch. Repitch, patience. I do appreciate the time. Thanks, Matt. I got to imagine the issue is 4 days of oxygen and stirring, and maybe too much yeast nutrient and exciter.
That could be. That sounds good. Also, I think the harsh alcohol flavor is probably alcohol.
Yes, that's alcohol.
Because 1.130 is really high, and 1020 is, I'm not crazy low, but that's a lot of alcohol in there.
Yeah.
And if you want to avoid the harsh alcohol flavor, and you're doing everything right, that's a lot of alcohol. Did you ferment cool? Because your warmer fermentation may produce more of those higher alcohols. Gosh, other than that and what you said, I don't...
Yeah, you need free amino nitrogen when you're fermenting a mead or an Asserglen. But if you use too much, it can tastes like rocket fuel in the end. You got to use just the right amount.
And I think the cereal stirring and the addition of O2 that way might not have been beneficial. That
I could see adding a second dose of oxygen after the first growth phase, another dose of oxygen. But I don't know about 4 days of it. I give it too much.
I've read a couple articles in the past that say that adding O2 You add it with the first, like for guys that are doing multiple brews into a fermenter. The first time you add oxygen, everything's fine. That's normal brew. But you push another brew house batch into that same fermenter and add oxygen. That one is actually beneficial, and that those beers turn out better than the first one with just one batch. The third batch, it shows some signs of diminishment. But if you do it on a fourth and a fifth time, those beers actually don't taste as good in taste panel as the beers that are done only two or three times. By adding oxygen 4 days in a row, you might have started creating some of those less desirable flavors.
Yeah, the my guide is always generally within the first 8 hours, 12 hours, you want to add that supplementary oxygen and then pass that. So when you're doing multiple batches into a tank, multiple turns, it depends on when those turns are. If they're coming real quick, that's fine. But if you're waiting to the next day and then brewing and it's later in the brew day, then that's bad. Yeah. I think maybe a bit too much oxygen. Anything you can do to save it, maybe regardless, the alcohol is going to be there. But I think if you added some bold fruit flavors, raspberry or something like that, or something sweeter, it may mellow that out a bit. Some of those alcohols could over time turn to esters with the acids that are present, could turn to esters. So maybe, I don't know.
Yeah.
Tough one there. Tough one. All right. Let's take our last break. And when we come back, we'll wrap up. It's right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew Strong.
All right, we're back. I'm here with my good friend Fal Allen from Anderson Valley Brewing Company, which is really one of my favorite breweries, especially when you're there. I hate to say anything negative, but there was a time you weren't there. I didn't think it was as good. And then you came back, returned to the great it always has been. So
thank you.
You are clearly the key there.
I don't know about that, but well, thank you.
I can highly recommend to all listeners, if you haven't tried Anderson Valley Brewing beers, you should seek them out. And if you're around the area and you're really close to Anderson Valley, and then you have 3 hours to get into the valley and see Anderson Valley, it's fantastic. It really is. It really is a wonderful visit.
Beautiful valley. And yes, for those people who have partners who don't drink beer, there are 40 something wineries here as well. So a little something for everybody.
It's a real cool place to visit. I got to get back out there. Let's see. Doug writes, "Hey all, check out my Brew Strong dedicated stir plate." He sends a picture of a stir plate that's quite cool. "Made out of an old car radio and laser etched it at my machine shop. My question is about proper etiquette when entering a beer in a competition when part or the entire recipe is borrowed from someone else. If I try to follow recipes exactly taken from brewing classic styles, should I rename the title or should I just say this is a rendition of McZanishef's Wee by Jamil? Also, I'm entering two beers for the National Homebrew Competition this year for the first time, and I thought I would consider these my own recipes. It brings up my next question. I want to name my squash beer El Gordo, but of course, a Google search pulls up a commercial beer that has the same name. Is it still okay to name it that? I'm new to competitions and I'm just not sure. Thanks to all the Brewing Network for making my beer better, Doug from New Hampshire." What do you think on that? What about the commercial beer thing? If you wanted to name a beer and it just for their own personal use and they put it into competition and it happens to have the same name,
it's impossible nowadays to come up with anything that hasn't already been done in names. So unless you're going to get really weird, which go ahead, get really weird. But I don't think it's a problem. You're talking about a commercial beer and you're a home brewer. There's no legal problem. You're not trying to sell. Even if they have it copyrighted, you're going to use that name once or twice. And if they get bent out of shape about it, that's their problem. As to the former question about the recipe, my feeling, and it's just me, I give our recipe out to whoever wants it, because the grain and the hops that you're going to use they're a big part of a recipe, but they're not the only part, and they're not the biggest part. Your process, how clean you are, the equipment you use, the water you use, and the yeast you're going to use all have a greater impact than whatever malt and hops you're going to use. So I think it's nice to say, give a shout out to whoever's recipe you may be using, but I don't think you should feel bad about using someone else's recipe, because it's your brewery. Mm-hmm. You did it.
Right. Yeah.
That's me.
I feel the same way. Because anyone who's worked in a commercial brewery with multiple shifts of brewers, you're using exactly the same ingredients. You're using exactly the same recipe, or you're trying to. You should. You're using the exact same equipment, same water, everything. Yet the beer can turn out slightly different, and depending on who's brewing. And it may just be a tiny little difference, but it's a tiny little difference. If you can give out recipes, but that doesn't mean somebody can make the beer. It's so much more than that. We used to do a show called Brew It, where we had, I think, didn't we have you on Can You Brew It? And it was a recipe you couldn't give us. It was like the one recipe you couldn't give us or something.
You have one secret ingredient for one beer.
Yes. And I think that was the beer. I don't know. But where we would interview the brewers, and small things like the amount of time in the whirlpool, all those things really add up, the amount of time doing transfers. I found that those really play a big role in how the beer turns out and whether you can clone it or not. It took quite a bit. Yeah. Short answer, you shouldn't worry about it. I'm very honored and pleased when somebody, puts a little recognition to where they got the recipe sometimes. That's cool. I like that. Friend of mine, Travis, he named several of his beers. This might be Jamel's Schwartz beer. This might be Jamel's Doppelbach. This might be. That was cool. I like that. But when I come to do the collab, I've got the name already.
Oh, nice.
Let's get weird.
I like it.
Yep. Let's get weird. That if we did a book together, we could call it Let's Get Weird.
Yeah.
We all be fun. Weird brewing techniques, weird beer styles.
Yeah. And ingredients.
Yeah. Let's get
weird. Yeah, that would be a fun book.
That would. Yes. Well, go ahead.
If it had smoked beers in it, it wouldn't sell.
There you go. This has been a fun show. I appreciate you hanging out with me and doing the shows. It's very much appreciated. I miss seeing you. It's been a while since we got a chance to hang out together. I got to make it out there and see you. Now that I have a little bit more time on me, I should be coming out and visiting more. And all you folks who are listening, please, if you get a chance, send an email to feedback@blickmanengineering.com. Tell John Blickman how much you appreciate that he pays for the show. It's the least you can do. You get in for free. That's the only thing I ask of you. And then if you're up in Reno, you do yourself a big favor by stopping by Brew Chatter. You'll have fun. Even if you don't buy anything, you'll have fun. It's a nice store. They got lots of stuff. And the clientele is quite fun to hang out with, too. get yourself a beer, chat about beer and brewing or whatever. I love it up there. A lot of fun.
And Reno's a real beer destination now, so that's a weekend out of it.
Oh, yeah. Make a whole week. I go up multiple times a year. I'm ready to go up again. All right. Till then, everybody, brew strong.